This is Invest Talk from KPP Financial, helping investors make sense of the markets one day at a time. Here's your host, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome to another edition of Invest Talk. I'm your host, Luke Guerrero, and I'll be with you over the next 45 minutes or so as we dissect what happened in the market today and talk about the stories that matter. Now, before we do any of that, I want to give you a quick heads up because our newest Invest Talk Wealth webinar is set for June 30th from noon to 1 Pacific time. That is just about 2 weeks away, and we will be discussing income. Specifically, the title of this webinar will be Beyond the Yield, How to Invest for Your Income Needs. As always, our wealth webinars are free. All you must do to participate is subscribe at investtalk.com. All right, now in just a bit, we'll talk about today's market performance and run down our show topics. But let's tackle this caller question now.
Yes, I had a question about First Majestic Silver. Ticker symbol is AG. And I'm looking for a pure silver play. I'm curious your analysis on this stock. If you could please run it down for me. I'm a huge fan of the show. I'll listen for your answer on the podcast. Have a good evening. Thanks.
Ticker AG is First Majestic Silver Corp. It is a Canadian-based primary silver producer. So they operate 4 producing mines in Mexico, plus their Jerritt Canyon gold mine in Nevada. Now, their CEO is probably one of the most vocal silver bulls in the industry. About 66% silver purity in production mixed with gold as a meaningful byproduct of this production. Now, over the past 52 weeks, this thing has soared up 142.26%, up 18.91% year to date. And there's no secret as to what's going on here. It's obvious what is going on here. I mean, revenue's up 95% year over year, near doubling, you know, driven by silver being priced high. Net earnings, $128 million. Free cash flow, $224 million. Operating cash flow up, get this, 182% year over year. Then on top of that, cash plus treasuries is $1.1 billion and total debt's only about $297 million-ish dollars, which means they have net cash on their balance sheet. Their silver production is about 26% of their full year midpoint after Q1, so they're on track for what was expected in terms of production, about 28% of their gold production. And so if you think that silver prices are going to remain high, and there's a lot of reasons to think that, this is a solid company to invest in. I mean, it is the purest high beta silver price play on U.S. exchanges. If silver's at $86 an ounce, this thing is making a lot of money. They are generating cash faster than almost any point in their history. This is the correct vehicle if you think it's going to remain high. Now, the thing you got to know about silver is something we're actually talking a little bit about today. And this was our deeper focus video, so we'll expand on it on our YouTube channel. But the reality is silver tends to be a bit more volatile metal. But the drivers, the macro drivers, the industrial use, and the fact that it's becoming more of a monetary metal are likely to keep demand high. So, as a company, and as a way to play silver, I actually like First Majestic Silver Corp, ticker AG. Thanks for the call. We had a great show yesterday. We looked into a story about AI automation stocks and which ones you should be watching. We also answered a listener question on an SEC rule change. It was submitted through our YouTube channel. If you happen to miss yesterday's episode, I encourage you to go check it out. And remember, the best way to never miss a show is to follow Invest Talk wherever you get your podcasts. All right, on to today, where our main focus point is, and I already spoiled it, silver. Silver is now a monetary metal because silver didn't just hit 121 because people suddenly wanted more silverware. It exploded because the market is starting to recognize silver for what it really is. It's not the only metal we'll talk about. We'll talk about central banks' repatriation of gold, how oil prices might move regardless of if there's a deal or not, and the requirements of that deal. Something else we'll talk about at the end of the show. From tanker giants who warn what is necessary in order to start making ships move once again. We also have voice bank calls ready to play, including one on dividend reinvestment plans or DRIPS. And as always, some questions that came in from the comment section of the Invest Talk YouTube channel. And hopefully we hear from some of you live throughout the show. Going into a break, it is always a quick one. Please remember you can call anytime and leave your questions on the Invest Talk voice bank. If you're listening via our live stream, you're on AM 1220 in the Bay Area. I encourage you to call now at 888-99-CHART. Up next, we'll talk about today's market activity.
There are a few things that make KPP Financial special. One of them is parallel investing. This means they invest right alongside their clients. Here's how it works. When KPP Financial makes a trade for their clients, Justin Klein makes the same trade for himself and KPP on the same day, at the same price, and same percentage. No front running, no special treatment. Learn more about parallel investing at investtalk.com.
U.S. stocks finished mostly lower today as the market took a bit of a breather after a three-day rally that saw stocks run up nearly 16%. The Dow bucked the trend to set a fresh record close up about 60 basis points. But the S&P fell the opposite direction with the NASDAQ dropping 1.2 and the Russell 2000 losing nearly 1%. Now, breadth, I would say, was really the only narrowly positive story. And overall, I mean, the session looked more like profit taking in rotation than any fundamental shift. Semis, memory, software, among the worst, biggest drags after their recent surge. Several Mag 7 names were lower. Networking, energy, pharma, managed care, chemicals also lagged. But the rotation into select cyclicals, I mean, it was pretty notable. You saw large cap banks, you saw investment banks, insurers, PE, apparel, home builders, all some of the best performers on the day. The Dow, of course, having a record close. Overall, there wasn't really a specific geopolitical catalyst for the sell-off. And the Iran deal narrative actually continues to progress. The Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, is said to be signed on Friday when final nuclear talks may begin, though the full text still isn't public. And there are understandably significant questions remaining around the path and the timeline to normalcy in the Strait and the role of Israel in Lebanon. Nonetheless, crude oil settled down 5.8% to its lowest close since early March, reflecting maybe the market is growing confident that we are headed towards a resolution. On the data front, mixed. Housing starts fell over 15% to their slowest pace since May 2020. Building permits also missed. Import prices came in nearly double consensus at 1.9% month over month. What else did we have today? You had a hotter than expected reading elsewhere on the inflationary front, kind of keeps that narrative alive. You had ADP weekly private payrolls showing a, what is it, third, fourth straight deceleration. That being said, I mean, it wasn't all bad. There was a treasury auction that was held that came in very well. There was some of the highest foreign demand in 2 years. And that's one of the reasons why treasuries were firmer. Yields were down 2 to 4 basis points. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, all eyes on tomorrow with May retail sales landing in the morning. Consensus looking for 0.6% gain, followed by the first FOMC decision of a Fed that is chaired by Kevin Warsh in the afternoon. No rate change is expected, but any edits to the statement and updated dot plots certainly will be scrutinized. The median dot is still expected to show no cuts for the rest of 2026. Why don't we dip into our YouTube comment section question bank? As I'm sure you're familiar, we have a YouTube channel, Invest Talk with Two T's, where we do YouTube exclusive content. It's where we host our webinars. It's where we post our webinars after we have them. It also houses our Deeper Focus video series, and we'll have a new episode of that coming out tomorrow. And while you're over there, if you have a question, we encourage you to leave it in the comment section. This question came in a bit earlier. It looks like it came in early last week or late last week. It says, can I get your thoughts on NU, New Holdings, and Rely Remitly? Thank you. Love the weekly wrap-ups. Always keep me up to date. Well, let's take a look at these names. The first is ticker NU, which is New Holdings. It is Brazil's largest digital bank. They're also expanding into other Latin and South American countries, into Mexico, into Colombia. They are a full-service neobank. They got credit cards, they got personal loans, they got savings, they got insurance. And in Latin America, they also have 100 million-plus customers. They've been having a good time recently. Net income up 41% year-over-year. Revenue and hit $5 billion. That was a record. On the bottom line, though, earnings per share did miss by about 10%. And what their CEO has really been focused on recently is an AI transformation strategy in order to rebuild banking operations. They have a massive addressable market, right? They already have 100 million customers that is growing. Management guided Q2 to Q3 EPS between 22 cents and 27 cents. So that's a reacceleration. Based on analyst estimates, it's about 30 to 40% upside from here. Again, that's not gospel, but certainly something to consider. At the same time, they are getting downgrades elsewhere. They're trading at 5.6 times book value, which as a bank is a bit expensive. Their leverage ratio is 6.6. That matters a lot if Brasilia's credit conditions start to tighten. And so that seems to be a bit more risky of a play. And then there's RELY, Remitly Global. That is a digital platform for sending money internationally. They primarily serve immigrants sending money home. They saw 25% revenue growth, net income up 332% year over year. That's pretty solid. By consensus, average price target implying it's like 35 to 45% upside. Revenue forecast to grow 22% in 2026. Excuse me. But the valuation, I mean, it's stretched 36.6 times price to forward-looking earnings. Maybe you have a bit of a market saturation, unsustainable one-off growth driver issue. I mean, both are compelling growth stories in fintech. They both serve underserved populations. NU is larger. It's a more proven business. It does have those Brazil macro risk headwinds. RELY, I mean, it's in the early innings. It's smaller. It just crossed the profitability Rubicon. It's kind of tough, right? I think in this environment, if you're looking for growth, probably RELY is the one that has the potential for more growth, but that means a bit more volatility, a bit more risk there. Amongst them, given valuations, I'd probably lean towards NU if I had to pick one. But certainly either of these are interesting opportunities, but both of these, valuation-wise, a bit stretched. Thanks for watching. We're headed into a break. Still to come, my main focus point about silver. And as always, more answers to your finance and investment questions. You're on Invest Talk.
I would like to know more about a company which I've been tracking for some time.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
And I was just wondering, are there any investment accounts with different banks that you would recommend? Something that may offer good resources?
Don't forget to call Invest Talk 888. 99 chart.
This is Invest Talk, now closing in on 63 million downloads. And Luke Guerrero is here taking your questions live. 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to John from St. Louis, Missouri. Looks like he got a question on TSCO. Do you own it? Are you looking to buy it?
I just bought it. I was just calling to kind of, it's a little late now, but calling to see, I value y'all's opinion, and I was calling to see what you think of the stock at these levels. I thought it was a good buy, and so I'm just calling to get your opinion on it.
Sure. Well, Tractor Supply Company is the largest rural lifestyle retailer in the United States. They do farm and ranch products. They do pet products. They do tools. They do seasonal goods. And they have, I think, almost 2,500 stores. They're sitting about the $15 to $18 billion market cap range. But that's only because the stock is down. Let's see, what's it down today relative year to date? Because it was at one point down almost 40% year to date. Looks like now we are down about 39.59. So nearly 40% year to date, down 41% over the past 52 weeks. I mean, in the past month alone, it's down nearly 20%. So you're seeing this continued deterioration with really no visible demand inflection. I mean, you know, there's really not that much going on that is likely to turn this from a technical perspective. I mean, it has very, very poor technicals. They have two consecutive quarters of earnings misses. They had a revenue miss. They had full year guidance lowered. This is a name that we used to hold for our clients that we sold out of earlier this year as the technicals were turning. I mean, it's put itself in a position now where it's trading pretty cheap, about 14 times price to forward-looking earnings. It still has a 3% yield. If you believe analyst targets, it's got potentially 50% upside from here. And structurally, you have a growing rural population. This has essentially been, if you think it's a deal, the best deal it's ever been. But at the same time, I mean, Q2 comps are now expected negative. There's been a big decline here. There is increased competition and changing consumer behaviors. The stock just keeps making new lows. And what was hoped for, which was a Q2 spring demand, spring summer demand surge, just really hasn't manifested itself. And so to me, it still appears to be a falling knife that is honestly a bit sharper than it has ever been. And so for me and for us, you know, we divested from this name because we think there are better opportunities out there. And I'm not sure exactly what the demand catalyst here is, should spring summer not manifest itself in terms of consumer behavior. So for us, you know, right now it's a pass, maybe again sometime down the road, because we did like the company for a long time. Thanks for the call.
Awesome. Thanks, Luke. I appreciate you.
Appreciate you. Let's keep things going and drop in another listener question now.
Good morning. This is Randy, the Iowa trucker. Just have a quick question about DRIP, Dividend Reinvestment Program. I know that situations change from time to time, so I just like to update. What is your current advice or recommendation for anybody interested in reinvesting? Or should they let it go to the sweep account and focus it on a particular part of their portfolio at the time? I hope that made sense. You have a great program. Thank you very much.
Dividend reinvestment plans. That is what DRIP stands for. And what that means is that when a dividend hits, it will automatically buy more shares of the same stock, or in the case of an ETF, of the same fund. Now, compare that to a sweep. That is where dividends land in a money market or cash account, where you as the investor will decide what you want to do with it. Now, the case for a DRIP is it is essentially going to be compounding on autopilot. It is automatic dollar cost averaging. That is effectively what a DRIP is. It removes the temptation to spend dividends. There are no commissions or transaction costs when you have those reinvested shares. And so if you're a long-term buy hold investor, it can make a lot of sense if you wanted to own more of the stock anyway that you would buy it through this DRIP rather than buying it with cash from the sweep. It's set it and forget it. There is zero effort required. Now, the flip side, why would one want to put in a sweep? Well, more control. It's a rebalancing tool. You avoid buying more of an overconcentrated position. Tax management, right? DRIPs create dozens of tiny tax loss at different cost bases. And cash sweeps right now are paying some pretty sweet, you know, juicy yields. In the current environment with money markets paying 4% and 5%, I think there's less urgency to immediately reinvest, frankly. And anytime you do get these dividends, although, again, it's great to be set it and forget it, automatic dollar cost averaging, I think you're missing out on opportunities elsewhere. So right now, when rates are higher, I think the case of being in drips is probably lower than it has been over the past decade. Thanks for the call. On the next Invest Talk, we will look into this story, Bitcoin identity crisis. Is it a store of value or is it a speculative tool? Bitcoin's latest price plunge is forcing investors to revisit a fundamental question. Why do they actually own it? That story is on Monday, or not Monday, because today's Tuesday. We still got plenty of time left in the week. That story is tomorrow, which is Wednesday. But for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
Stop guessing with supplements. Most of us take vitamins blindly, wasting time and money. Your body is unique, and it deserves better. Introducing True Diagnostic, an easy at-home health test. With a quick finger prick, True Diagnostic uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million data points and measure up to 180 biomarkers. You will receive clear digital results with a personalized 90-day actionable plan to improve health, boost energy, and slow down your aging process. There is absolutely no guesswork and no generic advice. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code INVEST20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code INVEST20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. True Diagnostic, spelled TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Use code INVEST20 for 20% off today.
Get ready for an all-new Invest Talk Wealth webinar. Beyond the Yield, how to invest for your income needs. Tuesday, June 30th, noon to 1 Pacific time. Learn more and register now at investtalk.com.
Silver didn't hit $121.67 on January 29th because people suddenly wanted more silverware. It exploded 147% in 2025, the biggest annual gain since the Hunt brothers tried to corner the market in 1980, because the global market is starting to recognize silver for what it really is, simultaneously the most critical industrial metal of the energy transition and a monetary asset that's been undervalued relative to gold for decades. Now, the pullback since then has been severe. Silver is trading and has been trading in the 65 to 80 range. It's down roughly 40% since its all-time high. And it has seen one of the sharpest corrections. Well, one of the sharpest corrections in decades. And it happened for the same reason gold got crushed. The Iran war pushed oil prices higher, which pushed inflation expectations higher, which pushed rate hike bets higher. And that in turn strengthened the dollar. Silver, like gold, generates zero income. When real yields rise and the dollar strengthens, both metals suffer. Goldman removed all rate cut from 2026. And they doubled the hike probability to 20%. That hits silver even harder than gold because silver's high volatility amplifies moves in both directions. But here's what it didn't change. There's a structural supply deficit. The World Silver Survey has documented five consecutive annual supply deficits from 2021 through 2025, totaling approximately 820 million ounces. Now in 2026, a sixth deficit is projected. Every year, the world consumes more silver than it mines. Those shortfalls draw down above ground stockpiles, and those stockpiles, they are finite. They end. The demand side is where the remonetization thesis really gets genuinely compelling. Silver occupies a unique position in the global economy. It's the only metal that serves both as a monetary store of value and as an irreplaceable industrial input. Silver panels are the single largest industrial consumer, solar panels are the single largest industrial consumer of silver. And the global solar build-out is accelerating precisely because of the energy security imperative the Iran war created. Every solar panel uses approximately 20 grams of silver paste for its conductive pathways. There is no commercially viable substitute at scale. Then you add EV electronics, 5G infrastructure, AI data centers. They're adding new sources of demand that did not exist even 5 years ago. In fact, the Silver Institute, they project industrial demand will exceed 700 million ounces by 2027. On the monetary side, the gold-silver ratio, the number of ounces of silver it takes to buy 1 ounce of gold, that's at 63 to 1. That is historically elevated. That ratio averaged 47 to 1 over the past 50 years and 15 to 1 for much of human history when both metals circulated as money. If gold reaches Goldman's target of 5,400 and the ratio compresses to its 50-year average at 47 to 1, that implies silver at 115. If it compresses further towards 30 to 1, which it briefly touched in 2011 into 1980, that math is pretty extraordinary for silver bulls. Now, the correction from 121 to the 70s shook out the leveraged paper money. Street reported that the decline was driven by the structural tensions of silver's dual identity as a monetary metal. It suffers when rates rise, but as an industrial metal, the demand hasn't weakened. Cable manufacturers, solar installers, electronics producers, they're still buying physical silver regardless of what the futures price does. The physical fundamentals, they never left. What left was the speculative positioning. Now, UBS cut its 2026 supply deficit estimate from about 300 million ounces to 60 to 70 million ounces in May. They cited weaker photovoltaic demand as a cautionary note. That's worth monitoring. If China's solar build-out slows or cheap technologies reduce silver's loading per panel, certainly the deficit could narrow, but even a 60 to 7 million ounce deficit is a market that produces about 830 million ounces annually. That's meaningful. Not to mention, it would be the sixth year in a row that that was the case. Now, when a ceasefire was announced, that sent silver up. It outperformed gold by about 0.5%. If the U.S.-Iran deal holds, oil prices drop, the inflation anxiety that has been suppressing precious metals since February starts to unwind. Rate hike expectations, they could ease. The dollar weakens. And both of silver's demand drivers, monetary and industrial, start to benefit simultaneously. Lower oil means less inflation pressure, which means potential rate cuts eventually, which is bullish for silver as a monetary asset. And a post-war economic recovery means more construction, more renewable energy build-out, more electronics manufacturing, all of which consumes, you guessed it, silver. Bank of America has a long-term silver target of about 309 based on the convergence of these factors that we have been discussing. Now, that's aggressive. But even conservative scenarios that assume the deficit persists and that the gold-silver ratio merely returns to its longer-run average, they point to silver prices well above current levels. For you all, for any investor, silver's dual identity is both its greatest strength and its greatest source of volatility. It moves faster than gold in both directions. The 147% gain in 2025 was followed by a 44% decline in 2026. That kind of volatility, it's not for everyone. Physical silver, coins, bars, allocated storage, that eliminates counterparty risk but carries storage costs and wider bid-ask spreads. There are ETFs that offer liquid exposure but are paper claims on metal held in vaults. Silver mining stocks, they offer leveraged exposure to the price but carry operational risk. The right allocation depends on your conviction, but also your tolerance for these types of drawdowns. Either way, the bottom line, silver in the 70s is either a broken rally or the setup for the next leg higher. The supply deficit says the latter. The industrial demand trajectory says the latter. The gold-silver ratio says the latter, but the near-term path depends on the same variables that has driven absolutely everything else this year. Whether the Iran conflict resolves and the rate hike risk recedes, this week's ceasefire is the first genuine catalyst for that shift. If it holds, the correction was the accumulation window. If it doesn't, silver stays volatile and range bound until the macro backdrop changes. Either way, silver's evolution from a commodity sideshow to a monetary and industrial strategic asset, that is the secular story, and it didn't end with this correction. Looks like we got the time, so here's another listener question now.
Hi there. I am interested in investing in a REIT fund and was looking into VNQ, the Vanguard REIT fund. And I was just curious, this seemed to be just U.S. real estate. And I was curious if there was like kind of a world real estate fund. I don't really know much about other countries with real estate, but didn't know if there was better opportunities investing in domestic and foreign real estate. So I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts. Thanks. Bye.
Let's take a look at ticker VNQ. It is the Vanguard Real Estate ETF. It tracks a market cap weighted proportion, a pretty broad index. It captures most of the U.S. real estate market. I mean, it's a pretty deep basket. And because of its market cap weightings, you're going to get pretty similar to other neutral benchmarks. It's got about 13 basis points in an expense ratio, massive fund, $39 billion under management. But you are correct. Most of its revenue comes from the United States. About 83% of its revenue comes from the United States, about 76% large caps, 18.9% mid, and about 3.16% small caps. It is a good passive way to gain real estate exposure in the U.S. market, but you're correct, there's not much international exposure out there. Now, people often ignore real estate as an asset class, and even though it's traded on equity exchanges in the form of REITs, they have different drivers of returns than REITs do. And so for any holistic allocation, it is an important and critical part. Now, there are some international funds. They do exist. REET is one of them. RWO, VNQI is another. RWX. All these are international, global REITs with relatively low expense ratios. And certainly there are other U.S. options as well that are U.S. only. I think VNQ is a perfectly fine fund, and certainly doing a bit of your own research on some international global alternatives would add some international exposure to the diversification you're already doing in your portfolio. Thanks for the call. The World Gold Council just published its annual survey of central bank reserve managers, and the results confirm a trend that's really been building for years, but is now accelerating. Central banks are physically removing their gold from vaults in London and New York, and they are bringing it home. France moved 129 tons of gold out of New York's Federal Reserve System between July 2025 and January 2026. The Bank of France sold those bars in the U.S., bought equivalent bars in Europe, and netted an $11 billion profit in the process, partly because of a premium on bullion in the U.S., resulting from tariffs. France now stores all of its gold domestically. India's Reserve Bank has reduced the share of its gold held overseas from 55% in March 2023 to about 22% in March 2026. That is a massive repatriation over 3 years. Austria, the Netherlands, Germany, they have all moved portions of their holdings in recent years. And political pressure is growing in Germany and Italy to bring home the bars stored at the New York Fed, driven by concerns over potential U.S. political interference, concerns that intensified when the president publicly attacked former Fed Chair Powell and raised questions about the central bank's independence. The survey numbers, they tell a story. Of the central banks that responded, 57% said they store gold at the Bank of England, down from 64% a year ago. 14% said they store the New York Fed, down from 17%. Meanwhile, 19% said they'd increased domestic storage or diversified overseas storage locations in the past year. That is up from 7% the previous year. That is quite the jump. Now, the World Gold Council's global head of central banks attributed the trend to geopolitical concerns and fear about maintaining full access to your gold at all times. The precedent that shook everyone was the freezing of Russia's foreign exchange reserves after the Ukraine invasion. If the U.S. and its allies can freeze one country's reserves held in their jurisdiction, every other country's reserves held in that jurisdiction, they're at risk. The lesson has been absorbed globally. Singapore and Hong Kong are positioning it as alternative vault hubs. Singapore's deputy prime minister announced plans this week to launch an over-the-counter clearing system for gold, along with a vaulting service specifically for central banks. The gold trading infrastructure that has been concentrated in London for centuries, well, it's beginning to decentralize. Interestingly enough, certainly this is not a coincidence, gold recently surpassed U.S. Treasuries as the world's top reserve asset. It is a milestone that would have been unthinkable a decade ago. Central banks aren't just buying more gold. They are demanding physical possession of it. When institutions that manage trillions of dollars in reserves decide they can no longer trust the vaults of their trading partners, that is a structural shift in the global financial architecture. The repatriation trend reinforces the long-term case for gold, even as the near-term price struggles. Central banks, they are the most patient, least speculative participants in the gold market. The fact that they are buying, the fact that they are repatriating, the fact that they are not selling, that tells you all you need to know about their conviction about gold's role in an increasingly fragmented financial system. And that conviction has not and will not waver. This is InvestTalk. If you feel like giving me a call and leaving your question on the Anytime voice line, feel free to pick up that phone and dial 888-99-CHART. You spend lots of time optimizing your portfolio, researching positions, managing risk, and leveraging the power of compounding. So here's a question you need to take seriously. What could poor sleep actually be costing you? We know that sleep deprivation can degrade your cognitive performance, decision quality, emotional regulation, and temperature is a key factor in determining quality sleep. Finally, the temperature regulation challenge has been solved by the ChiliPad 2.0, a water-based mattress topper. It actively controls your bed temperature from 55 to 115 degrees all night to get you into deep, restorative sleep faster and keep you there longer. It works on your existing mattress, so a new bed is not needed. Visit www.sleep.me/invest to get up to $255 off a ChiliPad 2.0. This special offer is available for InvestTalk listeners and only for a limited time. Order it today and get your 30-day sleep trial with free shipping and free returns. Go to www.sleep.me/invest and see why cool sleep is worth every cent.
Get ready for an all-new InvestTalk Wealth webinar, Beyond the Yield. How to invest for your income needs. Tuesday, June 30th, noon to 1 Pacific time. Learn more and register now at investtalk.com.
Jarek from Canada, once again, wants to talk about fundamental analysis.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I called last Thursday about ETF Volt, and you said that some of the holdings were good and some were bad. Mm-hmm. So my question is how do you pick apart the good and the bad when you're doing that? And like, what's your order of operations for doing fundamental analysis if I'm trying to dig into some of these holdings?
Sure. It's a great question, especially in an ETF that's kind of faddish like this, where there are a lot of, they're all doing well because they have a lot of tailwinds from what's happening in the broader markets or broader economy. So right now things are going well, but I look more about, okay, what's the long-term profitability of this business? What happens if, you know, there's a natural slowing of demand for AI data infrastructure? Was their business going to go back to losing money like it had been, you know, years in the past? That's a big question. Then I also want to look at its balance sheet. Does it have a solid balance sheet? or does it have a ton of debt that needs to work through? That's a big question for me. And then obviously the trajectory of its earnings, earnings estimates from their analysts. Are they accelerating? Are they decelerating? What is next year and going forward look like? So those are some of the things that I'm looking at. But there's also a lot of kind of sub considerations as well. So what part of the supply chain are they in? Is it something that is vital to the overall build out? Meaning no matter what type of chips are in there, if it's still running, if that data center is still running, then there's going to be services, there's going to be maintenance that allows them to still make profits, right? So that's why I kind of like the names that are closer to the electrical power demand, because you could switch out NVIDIA chips or AMD chips or whatever, and that might ebb and flow, right? But what it looks like is the demand for these type of data centers is going to continue, at least operating, upgrading, maintaining, etc. And those are the type of businesses that we are looking at, okay? What is going to be part of this supply chain over the long term, no matter what technology is in fad, right? Because AI is not going anywhere, but it will evolve. There'll be new leaders depending on the technology and et cetera. But what is clear and obvious is that the infrastructure to run these systems is going to be pretty consistent. That's why generally I like the idea of this ETF, VOLT, but you know, there's going to be some good with some bad, and you really have to parse all those things and more. You know, it's not just it's hard to summarize it in, you know, just a couple of minutes, but those are kind of the main points that I would hit when looking at the individual names.
Okay, great. Thank you for your time. Always appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for the call.
Hello, my question is about a 457 retirement plan. It's not something that I've heard many people talk about. I know it might not be offered to everybody's employer. But it's my understanding that is an account that you can withdraw from when you retire, even if you're not at the retirement age of 59 and a half, and it's taxed just like a 401k. I haven't heard much about it, but I just didn't know if you guys could extend on that and give any insight about the account. So thank you very much. I'll be listening on the podcast.
A 457 retirement plan comes really in two flavors: governmental ones, so city, state, county, all those types of things, and non-governmental ones, certain non-profits. Like 401ks, there are contribution limits. There are special catch-up rules in the last 3 years before normal retirement age. You can contribute up to double the annual amount if you under-contributed in past years. There are the ability to roll them over into IRAs, 401ks, or other 457 plans. There are RMDs, which start at 73. And their investment options offer mirror 401ks with mutual funds, target date funds, and the like. One way they are different, though, especially the governmental ones, is that they have a unique feature compared to those 401ks or those 403bs. There is no 10% early withdrawal penalty if you leave your employer, even if you are younger than 59 and a half. You can start withdrawing as soon as you separate from service. If you quit, if you retire, if you're laid off, but these regular income taxes will still apply. Now, if it's a non-governmental 457B, well, withdrawals are typically more restricted and may depend on your employer's specific rules. So, if you're a government employee, it is likely that you do have this benefit here. And I think when you have access to these types of accounts, having that tax diversity can be incredibly beneficial.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.